Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Why would a newspaper man call those who cut people's heads off and kill our troops insurgents, rebels, instead of terrorists? Why? Now, you have to go back 30 years to understand how perverted and twisted they are. Years ago, there was a movement in this country to change the way we looked at deviants. And as a result, they have blurred moral boundaries. They've promoted social disintegration. And as a result of the agitation of these 30 years, as Daniel Patrick Moynihan once wrote, deviance has been defined down. So, for example, years ago, we understood what a bum was. We knew what a junkie was. We knew what a pervert was. We knew what a suicidal maniac was, right? And most of us still do. But guys like those who published the Chronicle could still call guys who cut people's heads off and kill our boys insurgents because they don't call junkies junkies. They call them injection drug users. They don't call promiscuous teenagers sluts. They call them acting out their sexual imperative, for example. They don't call them homeless bums who need to be institutionalized. They call them rebels. They call them sort of Walt Whitman-esque-like rebels, rebelling against a oppressive society. And so what they do is they try to turn everything that's deviant into the norm, and everyone who is normal into the deviant. And so they're insane. That's why I say liberalism is a mental disorder. And if you're going to let those in the asylum dictate to you what you should be thinking, you're going to wind up crazy. So what have they done? They've taken deviance and eliminated the concept completely. So, for example, they've diffused your strong sanctions against pedophilia. They call it part of a normal erotic continuum, pedophilia. Anyone who took their own life was considered a suicidal person, and you would try to stop them in the past for their own good. I mean, there's no greater thing but to keep a person from killing them, to jump off a bridge, you save them. That's why people jump in the water to save others. The mentally whacked out liberals of this country have now twisted assisted suicide, which is a very stigmatized behavior, suicide, into just another treatment that should be available to a patient. Everyone has become a client, and so they have transformed your ideas about what you should and what you should not tolerate. You should tolerate all of these deviances and never call them a deviance, but you must never tolerate religious dogma. That's the one thing you must never tolerate. And so, consequently, they've broken down the moral boundaries. They have romanticized the insane, and they've created a state of social disintegration in this country, is what they have done. Without social norms, there could be no society whatsoever. There was a wonderful book written on this subject that you probably never heard of. It was an academic book called The Politics of Deviance by Ann Hendershot, written in 2002. It came and went. No one ever heard of it, but it's a brilliant book. I mean, some great things out there. Really brilliant people understand what's going on. And my job is to teach it to you every day in an entertaining format. And I try to do that for you. So just be aware of the fact that your tolerance is actually a reflection of your loss of clarity. Your tolerance for virtually anything and your anything-go attitude is not a mark of liberalism. It's a mark of the degeneration of your ability to judge anything. And yet you maintain your right to judge Christians, don't you? You'll judge Christians, but you won't judge Muslims. You'll judge America's troops, but you won't judge the throat cutters. You'll judge George Bush, but you won't judge Bill Clinton for what he did when he dropped bombs on the Serbian people. So you're really warped. You're just a warped, biased personality who pretends that you're an enlightened, advanced, futuristic human being. But you're not. And now most of America has awakened to the fact that A, they're not alone, and B, that they actually have the power. And you're now in the minority, those of you on the other side. You're on the dark side of reality. And we are going to try and save this country, period, end of story. Don't you understand it's really a battle? And who started it? We didn't start it. In fact, you probably grew up in the same world we grew up in. But because you were so quick, you on the other side of this culture war, to embrace the concepts of radicalism, you think that you have discovered something new and you feel you've broken the chains of oppression. When in fact, I can hear your chains rattling. The more you scream that you have broken the chains of oppression, the louder I hear your chains rattling. You are nothing but a monkey in a cage. And the more you scream about racism and homophobia and sexism and thisism and thatism and bigotry, the more I know you are nothing but a monkey in a cage and your chains are rattling. And let me tell you something, I'd like to free you. I really would like to unlock that chain around your leg and get that ball and chain off your foot, because you are a prisoner. And I don't even blame you. You're a product of our society. You've been brainwashed since childhood from television shows like that on KQED and PBS. I never let my children watch Big Bird. Never. I turned the show off. I knew it was a propaganda tool. And it was. And so forth and so on. You get the picture, fill in the blanks yourself. Take the pen and follow it through. Be a John Nagy. Fill in the picture. We're facing an enemy worse than Hitler. Worse than Hitler. Why do I say worse than Hitler? Because Hitler was unabashedly evil. Everyone knew that. Everyone could see that. It was no ambivalence about Hitler and the Nazis. Everyone in America understood he was our enemy. But now we're facing an enemy that's far worse than Hitler. Radical Islamists who have wrapped themselves in a religion and stolen a religion. And because of that, all of you bigoted leftists who have no qualms about attacking Christians won't say boo about the radical Islamists. Guys like Phil Bronstein in the Chronicle, I have no idea why he's still there, a failing newspaper that's in the toilet. The circulation goes down and down, and they keep a guy like that there. Not a positive word about what went on in Iraq. Not a salute to the troops. Not an attack upon these vile enemies of freedom and of everything that we believe in. How did this happen to a man? I'm sure he was a good man, raised probably in the same kind of family I was raised in. How does a man raised in the same background wind up like this? I will tell you how, and how millions of other decent people wind up in that time warp of unreality called liberalism. That is, they live in a cocoon where their ideas and only their ideas and that of their close circle are expressed. They never, ever meet anyone outside their small circle of liberalism, of liberals. They agree with each other. It's a small, closed circuit. And therefore, if they go to a dinner party at a fancy person's home, they express enlightened ideas. They know there's global warming, even though the scientific community is out on that. If ever there is a dissident opinion raised at one of these dinner parties, which is very rare, because no one is permitted into these cloistered environments unless they've been pre-approved, and unless the gatekeepers have approved of them and given them entrance to their fancy little parties of stupidity, why, that person is laughed at as a sort of eccentric, to be accepted sort of as an eccentric who's a fool of the other side. A throwback to, let's say, more primitive times in America. And so they live in their own world. The newspapers fail. The circulation keeps going down. And they don't even understand that they're going out of business because there are no consequences. There are no consequences because there's no ownership. If there was still a person who owned the newspaper, they'd fire the hack and say, damn it, my circulation's dying. I want a report on my desk by Friday on why the people aren't buying your paper. And then by next Friday, I want a report on my desk of how to make them buy the paper. I give that report in the next 5 seconds. Stop publishing anti-family, anti-Christian, anti-American, anti-military, anti-police stories in your damn newspaper. Start publishing stories that support those things, and your sales will go up. They know that, though. And we say, well, ipso facto, if they know that, why don't they publish those stories? The answer is because they don't want to, because then they won't be invited to these silly soirees. They won't be invited to the silly soirees if they start publishing things like that. So in other words, these newspapers, these anachronisms called newspapers, are simply social commentary for those who own them. It's their way of saying, here's what I believe in, through the factotums called writers, whoever writes for them. How do you explain talk radio in general being a boom industry? How do you explain a show like mine, a one-man band? Yeah, I have people who work with me. They're wonderful people. But it's all about me 3 hours a day. How do you explain this phenomenon? In a city like San Francisco, as radically twisted to the left as it is, I will tell you there's an underserved population in this city, for example. I meet them every day. I walk the streets and people come out of cafes and restaurants, older people generally, but not only older people. And they look at me with hope and they say, Michael Savage, I love what you say. I only wish that we heard it more. Over and over and over again, I hear it wherever I go. And I hear it at first here and then I hear it there and then it becomes a roar. And one day it's going to become more than a roar. One day this will become the dominant viewpoint in America again. Only it's got to become that sooner rather than later if we are to defeat the enemy. What enemy am I talking about? Radical Islam is the enemy external, and the enemy internal is the ACLU, the National Lawyers Guild, and the entire pack of anti-family, anti-Christian, anti-American deviants. Those are your enemies. They're trying to destroy your country.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show.
Santa Cruz, California. Jeff, you're on the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hello, Michael. I'll coin a phrase right now called the drama complex. You see, Christianity is a Judaic culture, and the left hates the Jews. They hate Judaism, and that's part of the reason why you see this conflict in our society, in this conflict between the neo-pagan, New Age left wing and the conservative Christian elements in our society.
Well, that I agree. Remember why Hitler hated Christianity as well, because he was a cultist, as you know, going back to the Dark Ages, the medieval times of Germany's past, and he cursed Christianity for being basically Judaism in a new form. He was crazy, as you well know. But the point I'm making is he also hated religion, as does the neo-left Nazism of today, disguised as liberalism. I see no difference in the early phases of Nazism and the early phases of liberalism. It's an optochiasmic switch. That's the problem, Jeff. Liberals would say, you're crazy. We don't want death camps. We're against genocide. What they don't understand, though, is that they're leading us in the same direction.
Savage.
As far as I'm concerned, the primary duty of a citizen is loyalty to the state. Now, this is going to open up a Pandora's box of arguments on this program. Because what I just said to you can set off a shockwave through you when you think about what I'm saying. Remember what Kennedy said? Ask not what your country can do for you, but what you can do for your country. When he said it, that resonated with America. It resonated with me. I was very young. It made me stand up and think about loving America for the first time. Kennedy was a good conservative. He was a sort of Democrat conservative. Look what his brother has become. Look what the brother in Massachusetts became 35 years later. Or whatever the number of years are. But John F. Kennedy, if you look at his record, would be a conservative Democrat. There are none left. He was the last of his kind. Now, the virtues that are necessary for us to survive as a state would be wisdom, justice, fortitude, and temperance. Have you heard these mentioned recently in any of the presidential debates? I am more presidential than the candidates. You show me those men. Take a look at those people. Do any of them have wisdom? Some of them may. Do any of them know justice? Some of them may. Do any of them know fortitude? Some of them may. Do any of them know temperance? Some of them may. But is there one candidate amongst them that can represent the cardinal virtues of wisdom, justice, fortitude, and temperance? I don't think so. That's why they're not qualified to be president. And what I'm getting to is loyalty to the state is what is missing in the quotient of discussion in America today. I have boiled the entire discussion down to a simple set of words, a single concept. The liberals do not argue for loyalty to the state, do they? What do the liberals argue for? They argue for loyalty to the self. And an extreme example of that kind of individualism, in my opinion, is narcissism, which is what extreme liberalism is. And extreme narcissism when it comes to a citizenry is the death of a nation. Now, I understand that on the other side, that loyalty to the state in its extreme form is Nazism or fascism. You see, I understand gradations on both sides. So don't assume for a minute that I cannot do the calculus of the discussion that I have initiated. But I am saying to you that loyalty to the state must be the common denominator. Loyalty to the state is what is missing in the discussions I have been hearing from these dunces running on the Democrat side. Not one of them has talked about loyalty to the state of America. All of them have talked about Medicare, Medicaid, and the environment. That's not loyalty to America. Not at all. I understand that the extremes in terms of loyalty to the state are obviously dangerous. It will be fascism at its extremity. But I also understand that on the other side of the quotient, the liberal side, is the litmus test of loyalty to the self. Now, I am an individualist myself. I'm very loyal to myself. Don't think I'm a little martinet who marches around Sieg Heiling here. I'm a real rebel, and I reject authority every day of my life. I don't like anyone telling me what to do, whether it's an airport guy with the wand in my crotch or a Ninth Circuit Court of Schlemiel's guy or a schmuck from Hollywood. I reject them all. But listen to what I'm saying to you. I am seeking for you and myself the balance. The balance between nationalism and individualism. And no one has had this discussion in America so far as I know. I am the first one in this country to ever have this discussion. I've never read it anywhere. Never have you read it anywhere, ever. You must absolutely analyze whether you are on the extreme side of individualism, which is absolute narcissism, which unto itself is very dangerous, or on the other side, an extreme nationalist rejecting the individual completely and therefore a fascist. Because at both extremes, fascism or narcissism, there is a mathematical implosion of balance, or so I see it. And I myself am trying to derive the proper balance between nationalism and individualism.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Savage. You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
I'm not drinking wine much these days, even though I used to be a great wine lover. Around allergy time, I can't drink wine because of all of the complexities. So I don't drink much at all, maybe a vodka, if I drink anything. You drink less during allergy period. Everyone knows that. But last night I planned on a hangover because I wanted to drink wine. So I drank some good California white wine, Sauvignon Blanc, but they screwed up the wine. It used to be good Sauvignon Blancs out here. Then they got to the point where they wanted to put in the Semillon grape, which ruined it. Then they wanted to make it malolactic fermented in order to make it more creamy like a Chardonnay. Again, ruined it. Any malolactic fermentation and I'm sick for 3 days, you know. So I only had a glass or two. So naturally I have a mild hangover today. Like a half a migraine is hanging in there. And that's why my insights are good. I always have good insights when I have a slight migraine, a little anguish. I don't know how it works. It's like when I'm irritated slightly. I have to irritate myself, though. If someone else pisses me off, I can't think at all. If I irritate myself, then I could think because I'm in control that way. But I don't want to go into my whole thing. It's not your business. I just want to share it with a few million people only, a few million close friends. So anyway, so it's an hour before the show. I'm walking around Justin Herman Plaza here, which is down by the ferry terminal. And one of the security guards says to me, he says, a camel just went by. I said, what? He said, did you see the camel? So I said, no. He said, look that away. So I run around. There's a camel. I follow the camel. I'm like a kid following a circus. It's exciting to see a camel in San Francisco. It's not often you see a camel, you know. So I follow it. I said, what are they doing here before I ran after the camel? He says, for some homeless fundraiser. I said, oh, boy. So I go to the square, and it's all of the do-gooders in the blue shirts, raise money for the homeless, this and that. So I get past my bias, because my opinion is the homeless should be imprisoned and put in a work camp, most of them, or in a prison or a mental hospital and give them the care they need. But I kept that to myself to enjoy the camel. So I come and look, and there's a nice middle-aged woman eating an apple in her mouth, and the camel is permitted to eat the apple out of her mouth. So I said, ugh, how disgusting. Doesn't she know about zoonotic infections, and I wouldn't do that with a dog, and this and that. I almost threw up, and a lot of goo came out of the camel's mouth. So I said, what is she, like one of the home? I didn't know. But it turns out her and her husband are really nice people who raise this camel on a ranch up in the country in Sonoma. They take in animals, which is something I want to do with my life one day. I figure after the heart attack and a cancer, maybe. I'm fascinated by wild animals to begin with. And I've always been attracted to camels. In fact, years that I lived in Honolulu many years ago, one of my favorite things was to sit outside the camel pen and observe them. I used to like to sit there. That's where I got a little skin cancer those years. I didn't wear big hats then. So I used to like to watch the camels. Their mating habits are very interesting. What they do to the girls, unbelievable. You think the Abu Ghraib prison is something? Watch a camel mate. It's really, Attica. They bite. It's just unbelievable. But that's not why I like camels. I'm just saying I like them. They're interesting animals, how they evolved with the two humps and all of that, the big feet. The hair on them is nice. And with the Arab thing. So it's a homeless fundraiser to attract attention for the homeless. People are wearing blue, and a woman's eating an apple, and the camel's eating an apple out of her mouth right out before I get on the radio. So I start to talk to her. I said, well, can I rent your camel or something? So we got into an interesting conversation, because how do nice, good Republican Christians wind up raising money for the homeless and taking care of camels? The answer is because you can't predict people. It's easy to make stereotypes out of both sides of the aisle. So that was an interesting exchange for me. I went away glowing.
Savage.
Fort Collins, Colorado. Katrina, you're on the Savage Nation.
Hey, I think that we need our spirits lifted, and so therefore I think you should be our wine connoisseur.
Okay. All right, ask me a wine question or tell me what you want me to talk about. I'm not the world's expert, but I know what I know.
I love Italian food and a good glass of wine. I typically go for white Zinfandel, like Behringer, nice, fruity. Mm. But
I don't drink Behringer a lot. I can talk about it, but I don't want to alienate the California wine industry. They're good people, and the tastes of people who drink wine are very, very different than mine. Let's say that my tastes in wine are very different than the taste that's prevalent in the wine business, Katrina. So at the risk of your displeasure, I will not answer that question. In fact, I find it very hard to get the white wine that I can drink without getting a smashing headache. Red wine I can only drink in the winter, and it can only be certain red wines, primarily Bordeaux wines of a certain vintage. I like very tannicky, very flinty, very sandy-tasting wines. That's not. In fact, it's so fallen out of favor that even the French are starting to copy the fruity California taste, which is a disaster. I have no idea why they did it. I don't. Women like the fruitier, softer taste, the Zinfandels and the reds that taste like cherry soda with a little alcohol in it. God bless you if that's what you like. I'm not here to tell you what to like and not like. I can't drink it. So I was very lucky. I grew up and I didn't know wine, because the only wine we ever had on our table was once a year some kind of ceremonial wine. No one drank wine. It was unheard of. Wine wasn't a big thing. Then I started in college. Rosé came around. I remember to this day, I think it was Lance's in a bottle. It was so bad. It was such garbage. It was some pink crap that we all drank. What do we know the difference? We got high on it, and it was good enough. Then there was some stuff that came out of, was that Lance's out of Portugal? Imagine Portuguese wine. It's an oxymoron. But we drank it. And little by little, in liquor stores, you know, in those days, liquor, if you had wine, who drank it? Usually the neighborhood wino drank wine. No one knew wine. Unless you were rich, you knew wine. But the average person didn't drink wine. They drank hard liquor, beer. That was it, beer, beer, beer. Rheingold, the Rheingold girl, Bud, Budweiser, Rheingold. That was about it. But, okay, so I got into some wine. So then, when I went to college, I wanted to know more about wine. So I started to go to a little French restaurant on the west side of New York that's long out of business. I think it was in the area where Hell's Kitchen, not too far. It was in Hell's Kitchen. I don't know how a French restaurant survived. It had been there forever. A friend of mine, whatever. Wasn't expensive. Terrific French country food. And they had tremendous red wines at that time. I don't know how, but I learned to appreciate what they had. So I liked Sante Mignon at the time, and that's what I drank. And I learned that dry, sandy taste. Typified that wine. Got a nice glow. Took the subway home, and I was happy. Very hard to find that kind of wine today, even from France. The wines that approach it for me, believe it or not, are Italian wines. Some Italian wines today are very close to those Bordeaux's in taste. Now, I'm not saying you can't find a Bordeaux like that. I'm sure you people who are listening know it. And I'm sure there are wine experts who can say, Mike, I can tell you, you know, where to get it. But I have found the 97 vintage in this particular type of Italian wine, the Brunellos, to be the absolute best, and they're very hard to find. If you go to a restaurant and you see on the list, sometimes you go to these restaurants, they got great lists. Look for the 97 Italian Brunellos because you'll probably pay less on the menu than you would pay in a liquor store because you won't even be able to find it in a liquor store.
Savage.
Do you have When the Moon Hits Your Eye Like a Bigger Pizza Pie? That's Amore.
When the moon hits your eye like a bigger pizza pie.
Follow the bouncing liberal. Follow the bouncing liberal at the bottom of the screen. You know, it's true. When you drink a lot of wine, the world does shine. You know, it's amazing. There's a real truth. But it's got to be red wine. That's the amazing thing. Now, a red wine jag is different than a white wine jag. I got to talk about that for a minute. It's a little off the track, but I'm going to get to something with it. I'm normally a vodka drinker and a little beer because I get a hangover mainly from wine. But last night, I go into an Italian restaurant in the Italian district of North Beach, and I'm enjoying what I enjoy. I get a bottle of 97 Barolo. Velvety, unbelievable, delicious, no fruity. And I'm tying one on, and I'm enjoying the prawns. I'm enjoying the garlic because I felt a little sore throat coming on. I knew that red wine and a lot of garlic and a lot of good feelings would cure me. And believe me, it did. It's amazing what's involved here. Wait a minute. So I'm enjoying the big prawns, no butter. I'm da-da-da-da-da. So my friend Tommy, the wine guy, comes in. I know Tommy many, many years. He's originally from the Bronx. He lives in Italy. He lives in North Beach. Tommy's the sweetest guy on earth. But he happens to play the player piano downstairs in the prosciutto room. In the basement, there are meat hooks that hang in this Italian restaurant. And on the meat hooks are gigantic hams known as prosciutto. You know, Italians say prosciutto. Americans say prosciutto. What they are is a Parma ham. It's a very high delicacy. And there's a piano down there. So after I had a tied one on with the wine, I said, Tommy, come on, let's play the piano. Go play the piano, I'll sing. We go downstairs, the room, it's dark, it's unheated, it's cold. You know what I mean? Now picture this. Tommy gets on his player piano, an upright piano, a little old broken piano. He knows 500 tunes. He's a wine expert, mind you. But he's a piano player and a singer. And he'll knock out one tune after the other, and he says, tell me what this one is. And he starts the music, and you've got to sing along. Well, I'm drinking the wine. He's playing the piano. I'm looking up at the hams, and all of a sudden, I'm singing, I'm dancing. I start doing like, you know when a boxer boxes against a hanging bag? I'm starting to hit the palm of hand with my left hand. Some of the workers are coming down, seeing me hitting a ham with my left hand. They start to laugh. Busboy comes over. I give him a glass of wine. It was one of the most beautiful nights I've had in a long, long time. You know, a little song goes a long way. That's all I want to tell you. There's no point to the story. None whatsoever. Other than this morning, I woke up, I wish I was dead. 5 in the morning, thank God for Uncle Bayer. Oh, thank God that Bayer had the wisdom to take willow bark and put it into a tablet. That's all I can tell you. Thank God I didn't have to go prune a tree and cut down some bark and get willow for the salicylic acid. Thank God they made it a little white tablet.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show. Savage. You're listening to an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show.
I made a mistake yesterday. Normally, I'm very, very good in what I eat. I carefully monitor what I've eaten for 30 years. That's why I'm still living, and I've been very lucky so far, you know, being an expert in nutrition. So I've been very careful because Dad died young, grandfather, great-grandfather. All right, so I watch my step. Now, I'm not a vegetarian at all, and I do like meat once in a while. I have for years. All right. I go into an Italian restaurant in North Beach. That's the Italian district of San Francisco. It's a hole-in-the-wall kind of a lunch joint that I used to know years ago. And I just went in. I couldn't resist. I wanted some comfort food. So I had ravioli and tomato sauce. No big deal, right? Now, they got a Chinese cook in there. Don't get me wrong. I have nothing against Chinese cooks. But I don't know if Chinese cooks understand Italian sauce. He put some sherry in it. I don't know what he did. I liked the guy, nice guy, but the sauce tasted so wrong. And then I wasn't satisfied with a tomato sauce that tasted like it had sherry in it. So I made a mistake. You want to hear what I did or not? Is this too personal for you? Because I'll stop. On Tuesdays, they serve some dish with lima beans. I happen to love lima beans because lima beans contain a certain nutrient that you don't know about that are anti-cancer. So I used to eat a lot of lima beans when I cooked for myself. So I said to him at the end of the meal, can you give me a half an order of lima beans? They're boiled, just plain old boiled lima beans. Sure, no problem. Well, I made a mistake. I ate a whole plate of them. They locked up in my guts like cement. I had no idea that they could, like, get together. They could mate inside my stomach and intestines and become a mass that was like glue. I had no idea this could happen. And it reminded me, it's funny I'm talking about this, shows you how my mind works. I got frightened in the middle of the night. I had a distended belly. Gee, this is going to get so personal. I had a friend who happened to have been very close to me years ago who once had something like this happen to him, only it got so severe he could not move his bowels that his gut exploded. And they had to rush him to the hospital and cut his gut open. He had around a 30-stitch scar running down the middle of his guts. Would you believe? And I had a paranoid attack that this was going to happen to me last night. Didn't happen. I mean, but I had that fear for a couple of intervals there. Like, what if these beans, like, became glue in my stomach and my gut bursts? I really freaked out. Hey, what's your deepest fear? Like with the lima beans? Oh, my God. It's unbelievable to me. I don't know what it was. He couldn't move his bowels. You can laugh at it. Oh, yeah, yeah. No, I'm serious. So no one knows why. And the surgeon hacked him open. Man, he looked like he'd been through a buzzsaw. See, he didn't have to. If he had come to me, I would have put him on massive doses of crystalline vitamin C, probably would have moved him right open. But the doctor right away, cut, cut, cut. That's all I know is burn, cut, you know, burn, cut, and poison. That's what the alternative health movement used to say about the medical profession. It's still true. Burn, cut, and poison. Now there's a place for burn, cut, and poison. There's also a great place for not burn, not cut, not poison. And that's what the whole preventive medicine movement is. But let's not go into, oh, God, don't call me up about this. Dr. Savage, I got trouble here. I can't move my bowels. I know what's coming. If I ever do a nutrition segment, that's what I get. Dr. Savage, I have a pimple on the right side of my ear. I ate something yesterday, a green bean, but it looked pink. Could that have done it? Because my grandmother in the ancient country had an... It is the most boring topic on earth, health shows. I once had one. You don't even know this. 15 years ago, I had a health show for 1 hour a week on Saturday nights in New York City on a major station. I'm not going to even tell it to you. It was such a hit, but you can't believe the questions you would get. Dr. Savage, I want to tell you, I can't. I go to the bathroom. I stand over the bowl for minutes. Nothing comes out. Oh, like that. For hours this go on. It was so awful. You know, you didn't know what to say. You felt like you're committing Harry Carey. Nah, you don't even want to do health. That's why I got out of that field of nutrition. Boring. People's bodily functions, yuck. I don't even like my own bodily functions, never mind a stranger's. I don't want to know about my own functions.
Savage.
I was in a restaurant. I like restaurants, then I don't like them. I love them, then I hate them. But all right, that's it. I'm a food-oriented person. I grew up in a food house where mom cooked all the time and there was always ample food, so... To me, life is food. Food is life. That's a big part of my being and my culture. And if you don't see it that way, then you may as well turn the show off and go listen to someone talking about brassieres. I don't know what you want to hear, but I go to a restaurant. I was eating alone. And because it was cold out here on the West Coast for two nights, cold, like winter, which I love. I wore a pea coat, a leather jacket. But to make a long story short, it's cold, so I stop drinking beer, and I start drinking wine. And shockingly, I drink red wine. And it's Italian red wine. It's a so-called Super Tuscan, 70% Sangiovese, 30% Cabernet Sauvignon, half a bottle, calamari spaghetti, boom, home, no headache, perfect. Slept like a baby, like someone had injected my muscles with like a muscle relaxant. There is no question red wine has a powerful effect, and I don't drink it because I get sick from it. When the weather goes below 60 degrees Fahrenheit, I can drink red wine. If it's above 60 degrees, so help me God, see, I'm a natural man. Now, let me explain to you why I'm telling you this story. There's a point to it that you probably won't accept because most of you are not in touch with your bodies. I'm probably the most natural man left on the planet. In a sense, I'm the closest thing to an actual savage. In the truest sense of what sauvage means, and you have to read La Pensée Sauvage by a great anthropologist in order to understand the mind of the savage. You can't just jokingly say that man is a savage and think that that means he's brutal and he's ruthless. It doesn't apply. You might say that man is a radical Islamist. That would be a better description of what you're trying to say than that man is a savage, because not all savages are as ruthless as the throwbacks. But having said that, here comes the point of the story. So I'm sitting there enjoying the meal, and what's next to me? I mean, a person. What people are next to me? There's a 60-year-old white male, tall and thin, partially bald. Looks like he's on a date. His date is some girl from woman. She must be a youngster, about 45. Maybe he met her on the internet. I don't know, a dating service. And this was like their first date. And I'm trying not to listen. Well, I don't know. She got gassed up. She must have been into the dessert course because she got quite loquacious. What came out of this, she was either French or Italian. She spoke very good English, but with a noticeable accent, that Euro trash accent that poses as class. Let me put it to you that way. And every phrase out of her mouth was politically correct garbage. The biggest story, and I'm trying not to listen, I was thinking of taking a piece of dough and putting it into my left ear. I couldn't take it. I started to squirm in the chair. I was getting like a direct megaphone. I think she was talking through him at me, thinking she must have been scoring points with everyone around her for her brilliance. It went like this. Oh, well, when I was in Ibiza, we were dancing, and there was a black man there, and he was very shy. So I came off the floor, and I reached out to him, and I danced with him, and he said, blah, 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 no one's ever done this for me before, and don't you think it's wonderful? Now, it was like that, okay? Every story had a politically correct twist to it. And, of course, her so-called date was agreeing with everything, because he figured he'd get lucky at the end of the night. Well, he had a... See, most guys have a theory about women. If you stuff them with food and you listen to them chatter and you agree with everything they say, you'll get what you want from them. It's a horrible thing to do to women, but that's what most men do. I think she was looking for a good argument from me, and she didn't even know me. I think she was trying to get someone to say, shut up already. You know what I mean? Put a cannoli in your yap and shut up already.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Savage. Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
Now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Question is this, do you still go to museums? Or have museums become museums in the United States of America? I went to the DeYoung Museum in San Francisco. I haven't been there, and I must have been 5 or 6 years. I used to live in museums. I grew up in an antique store. I grew up looking at art. And I spent a lot of time in museums. I always have. But I stopped going years ago when San Francisco's collections started to be dominated by the AIDS racketeers. And they started to turn everything in museums into a sort of plea for a special subpopulation of the American people. And I couldn't take it anymore, and I stopped going. And then every exhibit was so PC, you know, this and that and that and that. But, you know, I said, wait a minute. Although they have destroyed the museums to a great extent with this politically expedient dreck, AIDS art and art from every little subculture in the world, they put a basket from Guatemala next to a Rembrandt, and they tell you they're culturally equal. You hear? Nevertheless, the European collections are still there, and they still stand out, and they are still worth going to see. So let me begin at the end. I leave the museum after 2 hours, and I come out feeling enlightened. And I use the word enlightened in the way it truly was written and meant to be understood. I felt lighter inside. My spirit was lifted from association with great art. I stood nose to nose with Hopper and with Church and with other great European artists. You know, an inch from the oil paint is an astonishing thing to behold. And you can literally feel the movements of the brush. And it does something to your mind that you can't compare with anything else, certainly not television or a movie. So I saw some of my favorite old paintings, and they were amazingly fabulous. And I just love the intelligent young families with young children, mainly Europeans, I must tell you, sadly. Very few American families, mainly French families with their kids. They still take their young children to the museums, as I did with my children. But I'll tell you what I'm here to talk about, not museums so much. I'm going to talk about Ajenta. Now, Ajenta is a busybody in American slang. There's an exhibit in the museum that is just breathtakingly, frighteningly hard to believe it's in a museum. It's their lead exhibit. It's called Nan Kempner, American Chic. I have to read you the press release. The native San Franciscan's famous style comes to the DeYoung Museum. So I said, this can't be. They cannot be doing this. But yes, they were doing it. Here's a woman I never heard of. She died in 2005, I learned when I went there. And her dresses were in showcases. But wait, it gets worse. There was a whole glass case devoted to this woman's shoes. Her shoes. So I stood there laughing out loud. People thought I was crazy in the museum. And I said, by God, it's every Yenta's dream. There they are, the Yenta's shoes under glass in a museum after she's dead. So a guard came over to me and he said to me, he whispered, he said, you're 100% right. He said, don't tell anyone I said so. He couldn't believe it. I said, in all the years you've been in the museum, have you ever seen a woman's shoes put on display in a showcase? He said, never. So I said, this exhibit is the ultimate nothing. It's the ultimate nothing. I got to read you the press release from a museum that still has some of the finest art in the world. And you have to ask yourself, who is in charge of our museums that they would put a woman's dresses in the showcase and her shoes? But wait, let me just read this campy stuff to you. When I read the word the native San Franciscan's famous style, first of all, the first word that offends me is the word native. So far as I know, she's not of Miwok heritage. I don't understand why people who are so out of town as native San Franciscans make such an issue of being native San Franciscans. What does that mean? What does that qualify you for? Why is that special? What do you mean native? What does that mean anymore? So I'll read this to you. The style of Nan Kempner, noted fashion icon, couture connoisseur, San Francisco native, and member of the Best Dressed List Hall of Fame, will be shown at the DeYoung Museum this summer. Now, by the way, this exhibit started in New York, by the way. It was first shown in New York, so don't think it's just this out-of-town group of closet hacks here. She started collecting couture clothing 50 years ago when she was a young woman living in San Francisco. In other words, she was a wastrel living on her father's money and her husband's money, probably did nothing in her life except wear clothing. Now, I'm editorializing, mind you. This is my opinion. This is a press release for a major museum in the United States of America in the year 2007. This is what it's come down to with the assault upon our institutions in this country by the illegitimate left. This is the kind of garbage they're showing. So I'll read on now. At the time of her death, she owned one of the foremost private couture collections in the country with garments from Yves Saint Laurent, whose real name is probably Hyman Shapiro, Valentino, whose real name is probably Maxie Rosenberg, and Oscar de la Yenta, whose real name is probably Hyman Rabinowitz, in her closet. Nan Kempner, American Chic, displays nearly 75 of the thousands of ensembles and accessories she possessed. Can you believe this? More than 25 of the garments are exclusive to the DeYoung exhibition. The late fashion editor and arbiter, Diana Vreeland, said, there's no such thing as a chic American woman. The one exception is Nan Kempner. This exhibition displays Kempner's seemingly effortless chic style. Blah, 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 blah. Now listen to this. I'm telling you, this is in an American museum next to paintings by Hopper, paintings by Church, paintings by the most genius artists of our historical past. They put a Yenta's clothing in a showcase. Quote, Nan Kempner's eclectic style was uniquely American. She was known for putting couture jackets with Levi's blue jeans. It's a common practice today, but back when she started doing it, it was revolutionary, close quote, says John E. Buchanan, Jr., director of the Fine Arts Museums of San Francisco. Fashion is one of the earliest forms of self-expression. Nan Kempner was one of those people who made dressing and fashion an art form. And on, you get the picture? And then they quote, they say, Nan always looked so wonderful in my clothes because she had a body like a hanger. The thin, elegant blonde was said to be the inspiration for the term social X-ray in Tom Wolfe's novel Bonfire of the Vanities. In addition to her fondness for shopping, let me pause there. So in other words, here's a woman who did nothing in her life but be a parasite on her father and her husband and wear clothing, and she had a fondness for shopping. Kempner was known for her sharp wit and love of parties. You hear? Now listen to what passes for sharp wit amongst the closet people here. You know me, she once said. I'd go to the opening of a door. Cymbal shot. Nan Kempner, American chic, originated at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, the San Francisco presentation of the Young Museum was sponsored by Merrill Lynch. The ultimate nothing now on exhibit. And I could not believe that this is what has become considered worthy of showing in our museums. How did this happen to American culture? Answer. Would you like to give me the answer or would you like Mike to give you the answer? Now remember, I grew up in museums. I spent many, many, many a happy rainy day playing hooky from jobs and from various other places at the Metropolitan Museum in New York. Thousands of hours in the Metropolitan, wandering before it became a zoo, wandering alone on rainy Wednesdays or Tuesdays or Thursdays in soiled raincoats, wandering the endless halls before it filled up with the Euro trash and the school buses. I'll be right back.
Yeah. You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Paul in Oregon, Alan, KXL, go ahead, please.
Yeah, I made an observation, and the show was a repeat about a week ago. It went to commercial, and then after coming back from commercial, I didn't get to hear your explanation because it changed topics, and the observation had to do between the relationship of the perspective of a child and the elderly. And I also wanted to let you know that that's right in line with Einstein's theory of special relativity, stating basically that time was relative.
You're a very brilliant man, but I have to ask you to repeat the question. You're asking me to tell you what I think about perceptions of reality, the difference of perceptions of reality of a child and an adult, or a child and an old person?
You made an observation, and I've made the same observation, where you, I think you were sitting on your boat, and you said it kind of hit you that when you're a child, everything has a kind of a grand, big, bigger-than-life kind of feel to it. And then when you get maybe like I'm in my 30s, where everything becomes really mundane. And then
how a child sees the world. Well, I have a dog who has to substitute for a child, and so his perceptions are different than a child's, but you watch a dog react to things, and you see to a dog every sound is bigger than life, okay? It's the same to a child. To a child, it's all brand new. So what can you imagine what a rainbow must look like to a child? And as we get older, rainbows still inspire most of us, but we're somewhat jaded. I think that's what you're referring to, that kind of gross interpretation.
It is, but you said the observation was you start to get some of that back. I mean, as
when?
Time goes on, you start to, smell the roses.
Oh, you're saying that as you get older, some of it comes back? Maybe I was in one of those moods for a minute. Maybe I don't know why it hit me. You're saying that I said that I was feeling some of those things I felt as a child again?
Correct. I mean, that's what you were saying.
Could have been I had enough B3 that day. I don't really know. I don't have any explanation. It could have been a niacin.
But I mean, but that is right in line with Einstein's special theory of relativity, where he basically...
Wait, how so? What does he say?
He basically boils it down to where he's basically stating that time's relative. It's relative to the perspective of the person watching the train versus the person on the train.
There's another analogy which my friend, a physicist, repeated on radio last week, where he said the issue of monkeys on a typewriter. You know, monkeys are dancing on the keys of a typewriter and letters are typed, and people think that the monkeys are typing the letter. But in fact, they're just randomly dancing on the keys of a typewriter. Does that more or less fit?
No, I'm not really sure if that's really what I'm trying to convey, but...
Let's take the analogy of monkeys dancing on the keys of a typewriter. That would be the news people today, the journalists. That because they're typing letters that are somewhat literate, meaning that they're spelled correctly and they make sentences, they think that they're writing the news. But it has no relationship to what the news really is.
I do
agree. Or let's go back to Plato, where Plato said most of us don't see reality, we only see the shadows on the wall. Does that work for you?
That's closer. Like I said, it was just an explanation of an observation you made. I do remember being a child. I do remember every once in a while.
Oh, you're saying because I said that you were able to relate back to being a child yourself and remember what it was like to be a child. I think most of us occasionally, when we're super relaxed and we're really in a state of calm, we can sometimes look back and look for a moment the way we saw it. We can see the world as we did as a child. I think that's true.
Thank you.
I don't know what to say on that. I think it does happen, you know, to people. I don't know. Sometimes I say things on the show and I can't remember saying them and I can't recall what I said. You know, you talk about 15 years of conversation. I wish I could have that kind of recall. I don't. I'm very lucky, though. We have good archives, the crew for my show. Phil and Beowulf, I mean, they're really great guys, and they can almost access anything immediately. If I say, do you remember when, blah, 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 they can hit. It's not yet that well, you know, organized, but they know it by now. They know me very, very well. I have to thank them for that. Guys, do you know what he's referring to? I wish you could find it for me for tomorrow. Ottawa, Tom, you're on the Savage Nation topic, please.
Yeah, I'm calling to support your debunking global warming piece that you have on your homepage. I've worked with hundreds of climate scientists for the last 10 years, in many countries, and quite frankly, there is no consensus about the causes of climate change. A lot of the stuff that we hear, unfortunately, in the press tells us that there's this consensus, and so many of the scientists are actually very reluctant to speak out. But, you know, what you're doing and what others are doing are hopefully creating a climate where more scientists can actually say what they're really finding.
Yes, it's a little site on michaelsavage.com, which is called Debunking Global Warming, and the headline says, less than half of published scientists endorse global warming theory. That doesn't stop charlatans like Al Gore from saying virtually all scientists agree. It doesn't stop politicians like Jerry Brown, the Attorney General of the state of California, going on NPR 2 weeks ago and infuriating me by saying all scientists agree that global warming is real and it's caused by man, and we now have to constrain industry in the hands of government. And they don't permit anyone on NPR to get up there and say, now wait a minute, less than half of published scientists endorse global warming theory. It's amazing, the big lie, but then, as Goebbels said, when you tell a big lie often enough, it becomes the truth. Right now, the liberals are telling the big lie, and they've turned it into a half-truth, which they take as the whole truth.
And I'm saying to media that frequently bring this up, I'm saying, prove it. Show us that there is a consensus in the climate science community. And they can't do it because there is no worldwide poll, and the IPCC only represents a very small fraction of the world's scientists. So,
right.
In fact,
I got to tell you this, you could take the average person who doesn't know science, and if you go on to Greenland Ice Yields Hope on Climate, to me, that was one of the most important recent discoveries, yet it's never been broadcast by the media. It was an international team of scientists, multinational team of scientists. They worked for years. You know the one. They bored 1.2 miles into the Greenland ice shelf. They pulled up the remnants, the DNA of plants and animals that lived eons ago. And guess what they discovered? The Earth was warmer eons ago than it is today. How can they then say that it's we causing this uptick in global warming? There may be an uptick in global warming, but it's not we who are doing it. That is not to argue that I like pollution. I hate pollution. I'm a boater. I'm a hiker. I'm an outdoorsman. I despise people who poison the air, waters, and places. But I also despise liars who try to constrain to gain control of every aspect of industry around the Western world under the guise of global warming in order to simply induce a soft Marxism. Thanks for the call.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
I don't want to sound like one of those ancient preachers that ran around saying, you know, repent, the world is coming to an end. Or do I want to quote the second coming from William Butler Yeats about the beast slouching toward Bethlehem waiting to be born? But on the other hand, this is a very spiritual time. On the Jewish calendar, it's going to be a very spiritual time on the Muslim calendar when Ramadan begins tomorrow in some places. In other places, it begins today because of their interpretation of the lunar calendar. And so consequently, a big part of me, I think, moves with the tides of the ancients. How do you think? Let me just do something I don't think I've ever done before. How do you think an unknown man rose to this position of prominence in the media without any support whatsoever from the media? It's almost unheard of. Now, there are others who are more popular than I and bigger than I, but they have a huge machine behind them. They have a powerful network behind them with unlimited publicity and the benefits thereof. And it's good to have. There's nothing wrong with that. How is it that an unknown man, Michael Savage, could write four books in a row, each one of which winds up on the New York Times bestseller list? And I don't hold up the New York Times as the arbiter of what's good or what's bad, only that it's a yardstick of a certain amount of commercial success on a serious level. How did this happen? Do you think it's simply based upon my talent, my drive? My genius, some would say, or is it based upon something else? Do you think that there's another hand involved? Do you think, as Rocky Graziano said in his great autobiography, Someone Up There Likes Me? I mean, that was a beautiful title. I remember I met the champ a long time ago, and his energy was, it was actually frightening to be in his presence, I got to tell you. I was actually at his daughter's first wedding. I don't know if she got married since. She actually married an old friend of mine. And he was there, and Rocky was, he was like a rock, this guy. He was quiet, he was dignified, but he projected a strength and an energy that would really make the average man take note. That's all I can tell you. I was a kid. I don't know how old I was, 20, I have no idea. But you know, when you grow up seeing a guy who was mythological, and then you're in the room with him, you have to say to yourself, my God, this is unbelievable. But he was just as I thought he would be, overly powerful, bigger than life. And he was Italian Catholic, and his daughter married a Jewish guy, and they were married by a rabbi. I'll never forget this as long as I live. They were married in a rabbi's office. And there were only four people present. Rocky, the daughter, the groom and myself, and the rabbi. And I don't know what, but Rocky said something to the rabbi who was marrying his daughter. He said something about the Rock of Ages, put his hand on the Bible, and he smiled. And boy, I don't know, I got some kind of energy out of that. But then he had written an autobiography years later called Somebody Up There Likes Me. It became a movie. It was a fabulous, popular novel. He was saying he derived his strength and his faith and his success from God. Now, when do you hear this anymore? Where in the world do you hear this anymore? It is snuffed out. It's laughed out by the demonic elements in the media. The minute anybody says that, the jackals jump on him and say they make a mockery of him. Look at these schmucks like Bill Maher. These disgraced snakes. These asps in the media who mock everybody who's decent and everything that's decent. Look how high they've risen. And then look at the perverts behind them. Look who runs these agencies. You look at the talent agencies. I had a brief interchange with a talent agency. I will not divulge what I learned. But I can guarantee you that everything I feared was much worse than I feared. And so every disgusting image that you see that's generated into your head is calculated by these devils. Every image that is permitted to get out is calculated by these devils. And anything good is either snuffed out or laughed out by these freaks. So that's why I say to you, you'll have to forgive me today because I'm in one of these rare weirdo moods. And I have to step into my own shoes. And I can't hide it anymore. I have to step into my own shoes. I can't continue to deny what's obvious to many of you. It isn't even obvious to me. That I won't let be obvious to me. I have to step into my own shoes. This can't have happened by accident. It's impossible that I reach millions of people without any support whatsoever from the media, without any publicity whatsoever, banished and banned by Fox News, banished and banned by every newspaper in the country, banished and banned by God knows everybody in the media, never spoken about the unspoken Michael Savage, just as they used to do in Stalin's time. They would exile people whose ideas they didn't like by not talking about them. The Izvestia or Pravda newspaper, the truth in the ex-Soviet Union, had a small group of editors. And they knew who to deny the existence of. Solzhenitsyn didn't exist. They couldn't mention his name. If they did, they got fired. Today, Savage can't be mentioned. I'm not putting myself in Solzhenitsyn's boots. I don't want to be in his boots. He was a great writer and a great man. And I hope to God I never have to suffer the exile he suffered and live in the Gulag Archipelago. It's bad enough being banished to the world I'm in. But I take great strength in it as well. Solitude is not so bad. On the other hand, I got to tell you that this is not by accident. You think it's just the gift of gab? What do you think, I'm just entertaining? You think this would happen if I was just ha-ha-ho-ho, hee-hee-ho-ho, after 15 years of a show? Why would people take time out of their day? The show hasn't declined, it's risen. Why would people take time out of their day? And since I've started, the choices are even greater than they were 2 years ago. Everybody's a conservative talk show host, but none of them are conservative, you understand. They're all independent conservatives. They're all independent conservatives. None of them back Bush. They all are independent-minded. Every one of them is a combination of Einstein and Copernicus with a little Spinoza thrown in, mixed with Rocky Marciano. So with all of this competition, you'd think my show would diminish if it was by accident. It didn't. It grew bigger. So what I'm saying is there's another element here. It's the unknown element. It's the mysterious element of success that no one can write about. Now, there are many books written about how to succeed, and some of them have a meaning. I found most of them to be rubbish. The people I've known who've made fortunes never read a book on how to make a fortune. Not one person who I know personally is a wealthy man, and I know quite a few. And I mean wealthy. I'm not talking about a million-dollar fortune. We're talking about 100 million plus. I know a few. I know a few with over $1 billion. Not too many, but they built it on their own on a card table. Never read a book on how to become rich. Never read a book on how to win friends and influence people. Never. There's always another element. And, you know, I when I was in graduate school earning my PhD, I'll never forget, one of the gentlemen on my thesis committee was an MD. Actually, three of them were. One of them was a medical doctor who said to me that he's been at many autopsies or performed many autopsies where the man died of a heart attack and the arteries were perfectly clear. And he said there's always a mysterious element in health and disease. He said there's the unknown factor in health and disease. Now, you well know the power of prayer, although the media would, occasionally they throw you a bone. They give you the Reader's Digest view, which is that prayer helps healing. They got to throw it to you because they know you're the unwashed moronic cracker, not as smart as them. After all, you're not as smart as them to debase yourself the way they do, and you're sophisticated. They do things that their dog wouldn't do to each other, and you're just a cracker from the country. So once in a while, they say, well, those crackers believe in God and Jesus, so let's throw them a bone and say that the healing, that prayer helps healing. You know, make them feel good that we really believe it, Martha. But, you know, those of you who are not that cynical know that prayer has a great outcome. That's why you pray. That's why you go to church. There must be a reason it has been going on for so long. Sure, it's in decline, but why do you suppose the churches still have people who go in there on Sunday? Why, Why do you suppose? You think they're doing it simply because they're supposed to do it? Well, in the case of children, yes. But why would so many intelligent, sophisticated adults go into a church, cross themselves, get on their knees and pray to God? Why would so many Jewish people who were so successful or so intelligent still get in there and say the prayers of the ancients going back to the Bible, putting on strange head coverings and phylacteries, following laws that are so difficult to follow? Why do they do it? Well, because they believe there's another presence other than Rupert Murdoch. They believe that there's a power greater than ABC, CBS, NBC, and Fox News. They believe, in other words, in the spiritual world and in God. And so they try to pray to God. I once asked a religious leader, if God is so, when I was I was coming out of my atheistic phase, when I had turned my back on God completely and I almost wound up in hell. Maybe I was in hell. No, it couldn't be a real hell. Hell's got to be much worse. I was as close to hell as you can get and still be walking this earth. And I had to come back because I was so far down. There was no way to go but up. I had to bounce back up. Either it was that or it's over. But I had two young children. It couldn't be over. So somehow I found myself back talking to religious people, and I really went to the deepest element of the religious people I could find. And I once said to him, I was still cynical, though. I said to him, if God is so great, why does he need us to pray to him? And I'll never forget what this red-haired, rather feeble-looking biblical scholar told me. He said, Michael, he said, God doesn't need you to pray to him. He said, you need to pray to God. And in a minute, I understood it. Man has the need to worship God. In other words, inherent in mankind is the need to get down and to get down on his knees, if necessary, and understand there's a higher power than him. Now, it's the people get into trouble when they think that they're the sum total of all and better than everybody, and there's no one above them. You look at AA. What is AA built upon? Many of you may be ex-alcoholics and still not religious in a way, but you came out of the hell of drugs or alcohol addiction only when you realize you weren't God Almighty himself. Now, what do drugs and alcohol do for people? They take a person who thinks he's God Almighty with a crazed, out-of-control ego, narcissistic to the hilt. Most alcoholics are narcissistic. And when he wants to continue feeling like God, he has to have a bottle of booze, or he has to have that joint, or he has to have the pill or whatever, or the crank or whatever it may be. And you've got to keep dosing up, titrating towards God. You got to constantly titrate to be God. And eventually, of course, you can't titrate yourself up, and eventually you can't even sustain being an archangel. You can't even be a worm or an ant. And at that point, you have a couple of choices. What I'm getting at is it's only when you realize you're not God that you realize that you have a terrible, terrible aching need to worship. And I think that's why religion is sustained on the world today, whatever the religion may be, in whatever form it may take. Doesn't mean that you have to be in a house of worship. Many of you are religious in your own way, and you don't go to a house of worship. I know that. I think that my audience, being as independent politically as it is, would have to have an awful lot of people who may believe in God but don't go to a house of worship. That's what I would suspect. And in many ways, and here's the punchline. This show substitutes for the house of worship. That's right. I have become, in a strange way, the spiritual voice for millions of Americans who still have a taint of spirituality within them and have disconnected themselves from their religion. Now, that doesn't mean that super religious people don't listen. I know they do, because I meet them all the time. But I think that my largest audience consists of people who want to believe in something other than themselves. They know that there's something else out there, but they don't know how to do it. They don't know. They're too cynical. And so what do they listen to me for? Well, there's a number of reasons. I've been gifted with a great voice. I have a biblical level voice. I have almost a prophetic sounding voice. So that's a gift. I've had it since I'm like 12, adolescence. I remember when I was a kid and getting my my voice, God willing, I maintained my voice. It's all in his hands. I remember how weird it was getting a man's voice. Has anyone ever talked about that? Going from being a pipsqueak kid, getting a man's voice, what it's like, how it almost frightens a child? I'll be right back to tell you about it.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show. Savage. You're listening to an encore broadcast of the Michael Savage Show.
You know how I love my dog, Teddy, the 10-pound, 11-pound miniature poodle? He's like a piece of me, okay? I love the guy. Now, usually about 3 in the morning, he rustles around in the bed and he forces me to get up, which is convenient for a male, actually. I get up anyway, and he goes out in the garden, and I stand there freezing or whatever. And let him back in, and then he goes back to sleep until we get up in the morning. But lately, I'm like on strike. I don't want to get up at 3 in the morning and stand there and watch him take a dump in the garden. So what I did last night was he started like rustling around 3 a.m. I knew what it meant, but I'm not in a great mood lately, and I wasn't in the mood to get up for a damn dog and to go watch him, you know, stand in the garden there freezing. So I said, leave me alone, Teddy. Just do what you just leave me alone. So he settled down. I figured, all right, I get up in the morning, everything's fine. And no sign of nothing, this and that. Then I put him in the garden. I see he's doing the circle thing and the squat that makes every dog look like freakish and ugly. And I turned away. I didn't want to see it. But I figured, all right, thank God he waited the night. But it was a slow day. Everything's starting slow. The coffee machine didn't work. That Italian machine, it makes noise and it comes up with, refer to manual and you call and talk to some kid in Newark with like a Rocky accent put in the filter. And I almost got scalded in my groin. I couldn't make coffee. I had to go back to the Sears $10 coffee machine. The white trash coffee cup worked fine. I go downstairs to my studio and boom, guess what Teddy had done? Crapped all over where I sit next to the microphone and the screens. He never did this. Of all the places in the house, look how smart they are and how they'll get even with you because I didn't take him out. He didn't go in a corner under a curtain. He didn't run to the back door and say, Dad, if you find this, it's because you were bad to me. He went downstairs in the dark of night, snuck into my studio where I broadcast from, or I'm sitting in front of the computer all day looking for idiotic stories to report on, and he all over the floor. And here, he's here with me now in the radio studio. I didn't hit him. I didn't yell. I just left. That's all. I packed up and got out of the house. And here I am at another house. So what am I going to do? What am I going to do with this world? The dog is even, he's even breaking down from the stress of this world. Who can take this? OR, New York City. Anita, go ahead. You're on the Savage Nation.
Hi, Dr. Michael Savage. How are you? I loved hearing about Teddy.
Well, but it's terrible. I mean, you know, my life with Teddy, here it is. It's the ups and downs. It's like a child, you know. But who expected him to pull that stunt on me?
When you speak of him, it sounds like a little child. He does.
But I don't know how to put it to you this way. When my children grew up and left, there was a vacuum in the house that's the only parents who've, you know, had a child and have raised the child. When the child leaves, there's a vacuum that enters your heart, your mind, and your soul that only a parent can appreciate. And that's the good news, meaning they go off to college or whatever. You know what I'm saying? God forbid you should lose a child. I can't imagine that hole. But the point I'm making is when you replace that loss or that emptiness with a dog, they really become like a child to you in a way, strangely enough. If you love animals, you don't have to become a sicko to take care of the child. He's a very many ways, he's like a two-year-old child.
Exactly. I love animals personally. Myself, I just love them.
Do you love them when they crap on the floor under your desk? I don't.
Well, you just have to clean it up. I mean, that's what.
Ugh! I didn't clean it up. I ran out of the house. I think it's still waiting for me when I come home tonight. I'll kill him when I get there. He's sitting here, looking at him, smiling. Makes believe he don't know from nothing. I didn't even hit him. What can you do after the fact? He knows what he did. He knows what he did. He did it because I wouldn't get up. So tonight I have a real dilemma. Now I won't even be able to fall asleep for fear that I'll fall asleep and I won't wake up. I don't know what he'll do next. No, I'm not going to let him train me. Never. I'll have to deal with this one in another way. I'd rather talk about poodle poop than Hillary Clinton. I would find it more interesting to analyze poodles and their poop habits than to talk about Democrats and Republicans, to be honest with you. That's how far it's fallen. I mean, I'm devolving. Maybe I'm devolving mentally from the stress of listening to this rubbish day in and day out. Joan, WOR, welcome to the Savage Nation. Go ahead, please.
Hi, Michael. It's such a pleasure to speak with you. We love you. You're brilliant, and you're so right about everything.
That's a nice opening. Who can disagree with you?
I I just had to call you because I had a poodle, Beauregard, and he lived till 15. But
oh, thank God!
Every time we went out, we came home, and there was the poodle poop all over the floor.
Savage.
Warning. The Michael Savage Show contains adult language, adult content, psychological nudity. Listener discretion is advised.
And now, America's most exciting radio talk show, The Savage Nation. Here is Michael Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Now, I got to tell you, a day in the life of a talk show host is ordinarily rather boring. So once in a while, I have to make sure it isn't boring. So here's what I did. It's like, why do I do this to myself? As I told you, I have several studios around the San Francisco Bay Area, and I shift around according to whim. So I go into the city. I want to see people. I want to have lunch in my favorite greasy spoon Chinese restaurant so I can complain about the indigestion. So I have a studio in an apartment building that's a nightmare, a mess, run by the most, well, just say run by morons. And they've been working on refurbishing the building for well over a year now, wrecking everybody's life with jackhammers and smoke and noise, and nobody can do anything about it because there's no power for a tenant in San Francisco unless you're a homeless bum with a needle sticking out of your arm. If you got a spike hanging out of your arm, you got the whole city behind you. If you're a normal tenant, you have no power whatsoever in this sicko city. So I figured they were through with the scaffolds outside my balcony. And I get there in the morning, and sure enough, there was no scaffold outside my balcony. It was like on the first floor. I said, all right, I picked a good day. I stroll around town. I look at this. I look at that. I go have lunch in my favorite greasy Chinese greasy spoon. I ate the whole plate of chicken curry, got nauseous from it, left, went out in the street like a dazed bumblebee, been sprayed with Raid, the way I wanted to feel, because I don't want to pay attention to the news. I amble over to an antique store, poke my head in, once in a while I enjoy it, and I found an RCA Victor composition advertising dog Nipper, circa 1950, height 36 inches, and I said, what a great idea. I think I'm going to buy the RCA Victor dog. It's like a ceramic statue. They want $1,295. Now, I grew up in the antique business. I figure it's worth $5. If an upscale antique store is asking $1,295, it must be worth between $5 and $10, I figure. Since I grew up in the antique business, I figured I'd go back and look it up on Google. Then I found another thing I wanted, an English or American mahogany decanter chest. Remember those chests? When I was a little kid, my father's store, these would come through. I love them. They're like a decanter chest with bottles called decanters that you put whiskeys in and various beautiful glasses circa 1810. And the price is $32.50. I figured I'd buy it. It's probably worth $250 on eBay. So I come home and I look up these items. Well, I didn't actually get I didn't finish the story yet. I put them in my bag, head back up to the apartment with about an hour to go before the show. And lo and behold, nightmare, the scaffold's outside my deck again with jackhammers going and smoke. I have to race up to the apartment, get my bag with stories, race down, jump in my car, which I call Kaiser Wilhelm. I gave it a name. And I have to race out of San Francisco, getting behind every tourist schmuck ever invented, six to a car, gaping, looking over the bridge, down and around, boom, boom, I'm home 30 minutes, here I am, boom. So I look it up on the internet. And it's $99 for the dog. It's a little smaller, but it's $99, not $12.95. And the American or English mahogany decanter circa 1810 I can't find. And here I am, an English or American mahogany decanter chest containing six large and six small gilded decanters circa 1810. A guy wants $3,250. and the RCA Victor composition advertising dog Nipper, circa 1950. The store wants $1,295. I'm trying to find it if I can buy it for less somewhere. I once was in the streets of North Beach, the once Italian district of San Francisco. Now it's the home to bums and mainland China, with a remnant of a Little Italy left to it, you know, somewhere. It's like sort of like the Little Italy amusement park, North Beach. But 30 years ago, when I first came to San Francisco, there used to be women dressed in black. The old, like, lean Italian women. They used to gossip with each other on the street, whispering. I loved it. And being the kind of guy I am, I would once in a while go up and talk to them. Because wherever I've been in the world, I've had the capacity to go up to strangers and you know, I always get into good conversations for some reason. I don't know how the conversation arose. I was talking to one of the old women. She must have been a good 95, gone, probably Sicilian. And I said to her, Mama, what do you do for health? I said to her, you know, like she says to me, there's hardly anything that's wrong with a person that a little coffee, a little wine, and a little garlic can't cure. I agree with her 100%. I agree with 100%. Of course, I add a few things to that mixture. Like, it's not a little wine, it's more than a little wine. It's not a little garlic, it's a lot more than a little garlic. And there are other things I like to do. But for her at work, they were beautiful old women. They're gone, you don't see them anymore. I'm thinking of getting all 1950s items for a room, get 1950s clothing, like a bomb shelter. That isn't a bomb shelter, just call it like a time shelter. And go in it once a day, you know, like the advertising dog, Jack Benny, Bob Hope pictures. I just, another time, another world. It's crazy. The whole thing's nuts. I'm bored of it all. I know you are too. If I'm bored, you're bored. Or is it because you're bored, I'm bored? I mean, I can read the tea leaves. You don't survive in this business for as long as I have without feeling the national mood and sentiments. And I'm telling you that the people are turned off. The whole political structure is just in a world of its own. And there were many reasons for it, and there's no point in me insulting them. I do that on a regular basis. You know, I get insulted, they get insulted. What's the point? There's got to be something else we can do in talk radio until a dirty bomb goes off. I mean, isn't there something else us little people can talk about until a bomb? We wake up to a smoldering city, and the government agents running around in biohazard suits telling us to remain calm. And to get on our hands and knees and pray to Mecca to show that we're in solidarity with our Muslim brethren. And if we don't, we'll be arrested. There must be something we can do until that day. The only way to make sense of a lot of things in this world is to put yourself in the position of the nation. Try to identify with the nation as an organic body. The problem is many of us don't have any sense of nationality or what a nation really is. Our nation, our nationhood is being threatened both from George Bush and the globalists and from the Islamists. And we, the people, have a right to defend ourselves and our nation through nationalism. And believe me, this message is not being lost on old boys in the CIA, old boys in the Defense Department, and people inside the FBI who know what's going on. They know exactly what's going on. Thanks for the call. But it's not my job to do this. Don't you understand that? Who am I? Nobody. I'm a guy not an undershirt. The summer's over. I'm in a... I'm a guy in a flannel shirt with a toy poodle. I'm a guy in a red flannel shirt with a toy poodle named Teddy. That's really who I am. I'm giving you one man's opinion. No matter how vociferously I give it to you, it's still only one man's opinion. That's all it really is. That's all talk radio comes down to be. Do you understand that? And one of the reasons that I'm in the doldrums right now is because I'm an idealist. And as an idealist, I really thought that I could make a difference. I was never taken in by George Bush. Going back to the year 2000, I was very tepid about him. I knew what he was. I had no idea he was this bad. And I had to choose him over Gore because Gore would have been worse. Same thing again, 04. I knew Bush by 04 what he was. I knew that the entire structure was crumbling. I knew that they were going globalist. I saw the whole picture. I saw they were no longer taking positions on family values. I saw what they were doing already. But Kerry was worse, so I had to choose Bush and I had to support him. But as an idealist, after 15 years of fighting in the psychic trenches of this country's political battles, I am basically, I'm numb. I feel like I'm shell-shocked from it. What did we get? What did we get for from George Bush after all these years? That's so much better than the Democrats. Oh, a little bit different. Not much. Not much different. What Bush gave us was the same thing they would have given us on a slightly slower track. They would have done it on a faster track. They would have skipped a few stations. That's about it. They would have given us this on the express train, you know. Now, as a result of George Bush's seven devastating years, the conservative movement is completely fractured. Family values have been destroyed. World unity is in disarray. The American people don't know which way they're turning. And we're all sitting here waiting for the arrival on the scene of the arch-Leninist Hillary Clinton, who already had power for 8 years. You know just what to expect from her. Only it's going to be much worse this time. If you like Sandy Berger, a national security advisor, stealing documents out of the National Archives, he's a man who had to give up his law license for doing so, becoming again an advisor to Hillary Clinton. If you want to see the same panoply of perverts and criminals in the White House, well, you're going to get it. There's nothing I can do about it. Nothing whatsoever. Take a look at the 3Com deal. Many of you don't even know what it is because it's not being covered.
Yeah.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
I had such a bad experience on takeout last night. I have to tell you about it. I like restaurants. Don't get me wrong. I will go back to them. But right now, I'm not going to many. So, actually, tonight, I'm going to go to one. So, I did takeout last. It was a very hot night. And you don't want to eat. So, I wait till it's dark to eat. Now it's too late to do it. So takeout. I call it in and I say to her, okay, I want the frutti di mare, the pasta. I've done this many times at this place. I want no clams. I want extra calamari. So the idiot, the high school student taking the order says, all right, no clams, extra calamari. I said, then I want a lot of bread. Then I want broccoli, no butter. I want Brussels sprouts, no butter. But I'm going to have someone go pick it up for me. An hour later, the food arrives. All clams, no calamari, and no bread. One slice of stale bread. So I was so upset. It was late. It was almost 10 o'clock. I started eating. But it starts to gall me. So I call up in the middle of eating with the dog looking at me. I can't give him any of this food, so I give him a piece of cheese, which he loves. We're sitting there in the dark by the water. And it was enjoyable. I mean, don't get me wrong. But if I say no clams, because I have to throw them out because I don't like clams. And I only like the other stuff, a shrimp and a calamari. So they give me the opposite. I call up and I try to explain it to her. It's a chain called Pasta Pomodoro. I mean, I'm not ashamed to tell you because it's too many times already the same thing. Too many times the same thing. And they have high school students taking the order. So I said to the manager what went on. She said, oh, I can't imagine she would do that. I said, yeah, but she also told the person who picked it up for me that there was no bread left. She said, I can't imagine that. We got loads of bread. So I said, well, what is she, crazy, stupid, a sadist? How could you run a restaurant like this? I said, you know, I'm getting so mad at you by you giving me these answers that I'm thinking of doing like the dry cleaner lawsuit where that, remember that lawyer sued the dry cleaner for like $8 million for a pair of pants? I almost understand what happened. He snapped probably. I said, if you keep this up, I said, I'm going to sue you for false advertising. How many times have I said to you, no clams, extra calamari, and make sure you put bread in the thing and you send no bread? Maybe the fifth time in a row now? And I hung up on him. So this is what goes on. You know what it is? It's not her or the restaurant. You know what I found out lately? Nobody listens to anybody about anything. Have you noticed that in America today? It's in the service area, the service industries. Nobody listens to anybody. They don't want to hear you. They hate you. And it's not like my fault that I'm calling in an order. It doesn't make me a rich guy and that person poor. All I'm doing is ordering a schmucky takeout dinner alone in a house in an undershirt with a dog because that's where I want to be. Why can't they get it right? They always have to, like, give you something wrong. Is it the Bay Area? I want to know. Is this going on across America where no matter what you say to anybody in a service industry, they do it wrong on purpose? Nobody wants to do anything right. I've never seen anything like this. There's an anger. There's a subtext of anger by everybody. Is it any wonder that I take such pleasure in a simple creature like a dog? No. It's no wonder. Houston, Texas. Chris, you're on the Savage Nation.
I'm a proud father of a five-year-old, and I'm looking to get him a companion, a dog. And I want
yes.
you to tell me the story of how you met Teddy. And
you have to get him. I'll tell you, you could never do better than a small poodle, a miniature poodle, a 10-pounder. The little ones are too little for a child, I think. Like the 2-pounders, the child could accidentally hurt. But on a 10 or 11-pound dog at full, you know, full weight for a child, there's nothing better. This is like, I look at this dog sometimes, I think it's a living teddy bear. No matter what mood I'm in, Chris, as a grown man, he's the teddy bear I wanted to have when I was a child that my father wouldn't let me have because only sissies had teddy bears. You know what I'm saying?
Yes, sir, I do.
He wouldn't let me have a teddy bear. Oh, you don't need a teddy bear. You go to your girl. Girls have dolls. You don't need a teddy bear. But Teddy is a living teddy bear. Sometimes he rolls on his back, looks at me in the eyes, with his eyes, and I can't explain it. Dogs have ways about it. That's how they get away with not working for a living. All they do is look cute. But he's a great dog. That breed is smart. He's very good with children. He likes children. I've never heard a bad thing with him. Maybe he's a special one. I don't know. This dog was picked off the internet from a breeder in Tennessee, believe it or not, and shipped out by plane. Would you believe it?
No, sir, I wouldn't, really. Off the internet.
No, you wouldn't believe it. On the internet. I wouldn't know whether to recommend it or not. I really do think you need to look at the animal you're going to buy because you don't know. But let's just talk breeds, Chris. How old is your child?
5 years old, sir.
Oh, he's perfect for a dog. This is just the age that a child could learn so much for taking care of himself by taking care of an animal. He learns that he has to take the dog for a walk once a day, even if it's to take him in a walk in the backyard, let's say. You don't want him out in the street, right? So you teach him, well, your dog has to go to the bathroom and you have to walk. Do you live in an apartment or a house, Chris?
I own a house, sir.
All right, so the child will learn that the dog is hungry like you, so you have to feed him every day. The dog gets dirty like a person does, so you have to bathe him and you have to brush him. And the dog sometimes doesn't feel good, you have to hold him. You know, because that's how a child learns. How do they learn otherwise? Otherwise, there's no way for them to learn. Either it's through a younger sibling or an animal. I think this is a wonderful thing to do for a child. So I would recommend Teddy. I mean, you can't have my dog. I actually want to breed him. I cannot find a little silver 11-pound girl for him. He's 3 years old. I really want him to have babies because I want to keep two of the dogs. I'll have three of them. I don't care what they do, how hard they are. I got to have another couple of them. I want to have, like, continuous cloning.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show. Listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Hillary's donor linked to China missile trader Bernard Schwartz. Remember old Bernie? Oh, yeah, he's back in the news. Big man. He's on the boards of universities, now retired. He's an emeritus. Big man. He made his bundle now. He does the tuxedo and limo job. And that's the story about Hillary's donor linked to China missile trader. I got it from WND. It's up on michaelsavage.com. And there's old Bernie. Friend of Bill, remember old Schwartzy? Oh, yeah, he's on the board of the new school. Limo job and... who is Bernard Schwartz? And what does Loral Space and Technology have to do with China's threat to the future of America? How is it tied into the Democrat machine? I don't know. Read the whole article. You'll read it. I don't have the time to explain it to you in detail. Read it up on michaelsavage.com. You'll see old Bernie. He's back. Remember, there's a big hullabaloo in 96. He sold missile technology to China, gave it to them. We developed it through our tax base for the military. Schwartz had it reclassified as not defense-related, moved to Commerce Department. He then transferred the technology to China so that the Chinese could launch satellites through their rocketry with our technology. He didn't do it to harm America. He's a good American, old Bernie Schwartz. You know that. He did it in order to launch satellites cheaper than space could do it here in America. He was one of the first to outsource the launching of satellites. Smart businessman. It's like making a parachute with bad nylon during the war, and it breaks when the guy jumps out of the plane on a bombing mission. Look, you got to make a buck. Nothing wrong with making a buck. So what if the other guy's son falls out of the plane and the chute doesn't open? The main thing is you have the limo and the suit. You go around, you got the bow tie, you go to the dinners. Don't matter that the moron in Fallujah has a flak jacket that couldn't stop a BB gun. That's all. So anyway, it's all tied in its own way. You got to follow it. If you have ADD, you could probably follow this. If you don't have ADD, I'm sure you have trouble following me half the time. See, a guy like me, think about it. I've written 23, 24 books published, several. I have quite a few books unpublished in manuscript. I've done the DVD. God knows I've earned the PhD, two master's degrees from great universities. I've published scholarly work. I've raised a family. I could be declared ADD when I could have been declared ADD as a kid. They would have killed me. I would have become I don't know what I would have been. An accordion playing accountant. And there's nothing wrong with being an accountant. Don't get me wrong. I love my accountant. I couldn't have been an accountant. I wasn't good with numbers. Let's say a journalist. Top thing, I could have worked in a newsroom on medication. You're semi-literate. You think that you're liberal. You're smart because you can type a sentence. Whatever the guy with the mustache that looks like Groucho Marx tells you to do, you do. You start out writing obituaries. Then you write the religion column. But you know what I'm saying is something else. Don't suppress a child's creativity who may be antsy and jumpy and this and that. That's the mark of intelligence mostly. They become drummers. They become boxers. They become God knows what. What are you medicating it for? It's the mark of the child itself. So you got sick doctors now who don't have the guts to become actual crack dealers. And they prescribe medications for diseases that don't exist. And I told you I had a guy, Howie, in the name, but I'll repeat it. One guy I knew was a certifiable bug. The whole neighborhood, there was one bug. I don't know how old, 7, 8. He must have been 2 years younger than us. We were 10, 11. And he put on a Superman uniform in the house, ran around in it for a while. No one paid attention. Then one day he came like almost a traction. What happened? They were ashamed to admit. He threw himself down the steps. He thought he could fly. That was it. No one talked to him ever again in the neighborhood. I think they wouldn't even play like gin rummy with the father anymore, than whatever they did. And today, I'm sure he's a supervisor in Austin, Texas, wearing a half a skirt and a half a mustache. Or he's on the board of supervisors of San Francisco, voting that it's illegal to feed green parrots in the park, even though they love nature and they know everything about global warming, but don't feed the parrots, number one. And although we're liberals and we believe in free speech, Michael Savage should be condemned and be put in prison. And although Ed Jew is a third-generation Chinese-American, he doesn't belong here because we came from Hoboken and we're gay. And we know more about human rights. Just ask us. You see how it works? That's how it all works. That's how it all ties together. But you have to follow the show. You have to get into my syntax, my way of explaining things, to understand. If you're new to this, you probably don't know what I'm talking about. That's the problem. But it's after Labor Day. I'm warming up the crowd. They're not even in the tent yet. I have this idea. What is this now? Old hippies never die, they just become ugly. That's about the bee-in they had in the park. You ever see the disgusting drug addicts and sex maniacs there? That came to the park with the pot. Big deal. Dancing. 60s all over again. You take a look at those pictures. You could vomit. They still glorify the 60s in this city. You ever take a look at these people? Oh, my God. What do they do for a living? How did they become like this? You see the schmatas they're wearing? Tie-dye they left over. You wouldn't want to go near it, the bugs in that dress that girl is there. See that dress she's wearing, that tie-dye? It was probably in a closet just for this event 30 years. Summer of Love bands and fans jam in Golden Gate Park. Kay Left and Heather danced to the music of the Rowan Brothers on Sunday at a free concert celebrating the 40th anniversary of the San Francisco Summer of Love. It was a summer of drugs and hate. It was a summer of love at Speedway Meadow. Yeah, it's called Speedway Meadow for a reason. It has nothing to do with cars going fast. Still jamming, huh? Hoo-hoo. 4L. Take a look at this motley crew. Everybody you look at in that crowd, let's say you look at that crowd. the pictures from the event, the Being Again thing? Every face you're looking at in that crowd, let's say everybody in there, anyone who went to that, do you realize that every picture and every person in that face is a tragedy to some family or other in the United States of America? Here's another one. Summer of Love, bands and fans jam at Golden Gate Park. All of the would-bes, wannabes. You look at the faces. Look carefully. There's some old hippies. In my day, they would have been like a rabbi. Now, the hair is long already. They're looking for... They're still trying to grab some at the, you know, a late age. They figure they're going to go there and see under someone's dress. Completely fallen people. They don't talk to anyone in the family. Nobody talks to them from New York or New Jersey anymore because they know they were nobody. They're kind of like wearing like an Aloha shirt for 30 years, the same shirt. It's like a good luck shirt, and it's got BO in it. You know the type I mean? There's guys around like that. How come they don't wash the shirt? Well, it's good luck. I started wearing it in 1969. I don't want to wash the stink out of it. So if you look at that, these pictures, every face in that picture, every young, every old person, every person in that picture is a tragedy to some family or other, both locally and nationally. Everyone. There's nobody there who did any good in their whole life. Nobody. Every last one of them, old hippies. So that my headline on the website is old hippies never die, they just become ugly. Am I mean-spirited for saying a thing like that? For telling you about Schwartz and Loral? For telling you that drug companies are poisoning our children? For telling you that the Democrats are the biggest liars in the history of this government? For telling you I don't believe that Bush cries a lot, I believe that God cries a lot because of Bush? Does that make me a mean-spirited guy? I don't think so. I don't think so at all. Then you got Whoopi Cushion Goldberg, a failure for the last 20 years. The only reason she's around is for the reasons you can understand. It's like affirmative action and entertainment. Fails in radio, now she's on TV again. What does she defend? She defends a guy who has dogs kill each other. But does anyone say anything? Oh, no. Why? Because she's a double minority. How could you say anything to Whoopi Cushion Goldberg? What else is in there? And poor Jerry Lewis. $80 million for muscular dystrophy, but he says half the F word, and bingo, the gay mafia wakes up after a bender, a three-day bender, and they who's on the list today? Oh, Jerry Lewis, rip him to shreds. He's no good. Not money for us. Let's hear Jerry Lewis.
We're into hour 18. Look how good he moves that camera over here. Son of a gun. Wherever I go, he goes. Let's see what you do with this over here. Oh, your family has come to see you. You remember Bart, your older son? Jesse, the illiterate... No.
Oh, he said the F word. He's finished. Doesn't matter, he raised $62 million for muscular dystrophy. He got the gay mafia mad. Ooh. Such a genius, Jerry Lou. Even the French, they loved him. Well, okay, for reasons I didn't... they loved him for different reasons than me, the French. I loved him because he was funny. They loved him because he was a stereotypical funny Jew, so they could laugh at Jews. That's why the French loved Jerry Lewis. It's not that they thought he was funny. They liked the Jew mocking Jewish-like behavior. That was like the anti-Semitism, and no one understands that about the French. You have to understand the French mind to understand why they glorify so many American artists. It's not that they actually think they do great work. They're mocking them. Because they mock everybody. That's why the whole nation is worthless. There's nothing positive coming out of France today. Zero. They can't even make a car in France. They used to make good. They made like the Mirage jet was a fabulous jet. I was watching the dogfight series on TV the other day. I bought the whole set the year one. I couldn't believe it. It was a great weekend. I don't mean Michael Vick with animal fights. I mean airplane dogfights. So probably one of the best things ever made in the history of television. I've never seen anything like it. So it's like about dog fighting, and they show the events that went on. Some of the pilots they were able to interview, they're still living, like 85 years old, who actually did the dog fighting, World War II, some in Korea, some in Vietnam, and some go back to other events. So I started with World War II, then I jumped to the one on the 1967 Israeli War, and you see these guys. And they flew the Mirage jet against MiG-17s. And the strategy and the genius and the guts that these guys had. And you look at these guys, these Jewish guys, these Israelis, for example. These are the ones that they showed them then, like pictures of these handsome, like desert warrior types then. And older men now, still very bold and noble men in their 50s or 60s. And what struck me was the type still exists in Hollywood, but they're making pornography now. In other words, where did these guys go? What happened to them? What happened to the Jewish state? Everyone was so proud of them in the 60s. Then you like close your eyes and you wake up. It's like the ancient hippies, the aging hippies, who are ashamed to some family across America, every face in the picture. And now you look in Hollywood. Instead of being like old warriors who flew against MiG-17s over the Sinai, they made pornography in the valley. You know what I'm saying? And they left their wife for a 19-year-old, a 19-year-old hooker they met. How does this happen to a world? It's one man's reflections. And again, you have to follow the show on a regular basis to understand what I am talking about. Unless you understand my entire gestalt, the gestalt of Michael Savage, you can't understand this. I would think this is very hard for a new listener. I heard he's good. What's he talking about? What does he mean, airplanes? How does he go from Ritalin to Sinai? What is he talking about? How does he go from depression, the guy who called and wanted to kill himself, and talk about guys who flew against the MiG-17? I don't understand this. What's wrong with me? Why does he support Jerry Lewis when he said that word that they beeped? Why? What does he mean, the French are anti? I don't get it. It's too hard for me. I can't think. Give me a drug. Now go to watch Jay Leno. That's your speed. Two-dimension. Jay Leno on fish oils is two-dimensional. That's on a good day. Look. Who's the guy who was on the show who wants to be president? I called him an old glue horse. Larry Craig? Fred, they're all the same to me. Larry Craig, Fred Thompson, they all look alike to me. Fred Thompson has as much chance to become president as the statue of Dante that I have in my studio that I'm looking at. Why would anyone vote for a glue horse who goes on Jay Leno and want him to protect us from the evils of the world? Who? Who would want this? Right or wrong? Oh, hang on. No, Mike, he's really good. He's solid. Yeah, he's a solid. Why, he looks like a played the president. Well, what's the solid? What has he done that's good? Should he move back to Canada? Someone's asking me if they want to move to Canada. How do I know he should move? Look at these callers I got. I got a migraine from the topics already. And then you got the hippies in the park here in San Francisco. Crowd estimated 50,000 losers. The day began with blessings offered by Native American shamans. What they meant was shamed Native Americans who were no longer welcome on the reservation. As they call them, shamed men. Native American shamed men, and ended 9 hours later with Joly Valenti, son of the late Dino Valenti. They listen to these people of Quicksilver Messenger Service singing his dad's song "Get Together." Wow, I missed that. Shoo, once in a lifetime. Whew. It's never too late for another summer of love, said Wes Scoop Nisker, former underground radio newscaster. Wow, how far out? Underground radio newscaster. Ooh, I missed him. I haven't felt like this since 1969, said Woodstock concert producer Artie Kornfeld, one of the many Red Diaper Doper Baby counterculture heroes who appeared during the brief intermissions in the crisply efficient production. The old hippies look a little worn. No kidding. They should be where Jerry Garcia is, enjoying it. Paul Kantner, oh my God, that loser is still around? Who is he? Did he bring his walker or the trend? Was he able to play with the transfusion tree or not? Beat poet Michael McClure? That guy was nobody when he was somebody. The only person who thought Michael McClure was a poet was Lawrence Ferlinghetti, who was a clever businessman in disguise. Oh my God, they're still around? How do they stay alive? What is it, from eating beans or something? Why, it's from running out on bills in North Beach in the 70s. I went to dinner with a lot of these guys. You go to, like, these are all, like, with the proletariat, down with the proletariat. We're with the people, man. We're down with the people. All these great poets. We used to eat in North Beach in these big family-style Italian restaurants. And when the bill came, they paid to the penny if they paid that and ran out with no tip. They left the waiter, you know what they left the waiter? Spittle on the table. That's what they left. There was, like, 8 cents left on it. Did you ever go to dinner with, like, old hippies? But they leave for a tip 8 cents. They're all ashamed to somebody. Some family somewhere in New Jersey is broken from them. That's all I know. Somebody in Staten Island has a broken heart. They're buried in a grave. Everyone that they're mentioning here, they don't go back home for nothing. Not a religious ceremony, a wedding. No one wants to know them. They're outcasts. But they're reliving. Every face in those pictures that you see reprinted on the republished on the website, every face you are looking at that went to this reenactment of the Summer of Hate and Summer of Drug Addiction in San Francisco, every last one of them. Do you realize when you look at them that every last one of them reflects a tragedy to some family or other in the United States of America. It's unbelievable to me. I'm going to read on an article. At the far end of the field, a cluster of food stands. Let me ask you something. Would you eat food at a food stand at a hippie festival? And arts and crafts booths, probably all made in China. Stanley Moose, the psychedelic artist who drew the Grateful Dead skull and roses. Ooh, I missed him too? Wow, God, did I miss this stuff. I was on my boat driving it under the San Francisco Bay Bridge. I wanted to see the genius of the contractor who floated like a 50-foot section off the bridge and on the bridge in 2 days and got it back up before it was expected to go up, because it's not Caltrans. It wasn't a state that did it. It was a private contractor. The guy should be given a Nobel Prize. I went out in the boat in the rough water with the white waves, the spray hitting me in the face. I felt a smile come over my face.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
Savage.
You're listening to an encore broadcast of The Michael Savage Show.
I got to tell a half man, half woman story in Long Beach. I am not talking about the supervisors of San Francisco. I'm talking about a long time ago in New York City. Dad had a small antique store. I told you he sold clocks and figures and statues, mainly 19th century French, and some of it was very good. So amongst the many customers, one of them was a circus performer in the freak show of Ringling Brothers who would get up there, half man, half woman. I don't know. He had a breast on one side and the other side he didn't. I don't know how they did with a half a beard. But, you know, after work, he was a regular person, and he lived in a house in Long Beach, like one of those little Godfather houses. So Dad would deliver the work after work. He delivered his own, you know, sales. He didn't have a delivery boy. And I would, you know, I was the kid. I'd go along on the ride, whether it would be the DeSoto or the Cadillac Model 62 with the statues in the back. And we pull up late at night because this guy didn't like to come out during the day. I'll never forget this as long as I live. So the circus guy, the half man, half woman, ring, ring, who's there? Blah, blah, blah. So the guy opens the door, but he can't open the door all the way. He can only open it a crack. Why can he only? And he has to, like, pull the door and push stuff to get. And the house is now littered with art objects in no particular order. Hundreds of statues and paintings on the floor, nothing hung right. He would buy one beautiful thing after another and just randomly put it on the floor like a warehouse.